The Guardian.
Hi there, Football Weekly people. Can you keep a secret? Until the 9th of December, our friends at The Guardian Bookshop are running a very special offer just for you. They've got copies of I Am The Secret Footballer for just £6.50. That's 50% off the normal price and cheaper than anywhere else on the net. Hurry on over to guardianbookshop.co.uk/secretfootballer and use the offer code FOOTBALL. But remember, it's our little secret.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, so much football, so little to say after midweek round of Mayor. Still, max headroom as United and City go well clear at the top of the table. Plus, further down, more zeros than attack on Pearl Harbor, more nils than a Danish phone book, more bore draws than a South African cabinet maker. It's Benitez Blues Part 2 as Chelsea have goalless game with the Cottagers. As they head into their toughest month of the season, what lies in store for them starting at Upton Park? There's news on the big battles at the bottom and so much more, plus the word from Sid on the big Real Madrid-Atleti Madrid derby coming up this weekend. All that and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Well, listeners, my word, there's been a lot of football and there's going to be even more. Trying to make sense of it all, here's Barry Glendinning.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. Jacob Steinberg.
Hello.
Off the TV.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's me.
Yep. CNN?
CNN.
What were you doing?
Talking about some anti-Semitic stuff. Anti-Semitism, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
In football.
In football. Right. I want to kick it out.
You're really milking the chicken.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Where do you want to kick it into? This is like the cat
bin.
In the hat with
the
spots,
kick it into
isn't
the bin.
It? In the
yeah.
bin.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
James Horncastle.
Yeah.
Hey, you were at that the West Ham Spurs game as well, weren't you?
I was, yeah.
Right.
Were you chanting?
Exactly.
Was it? No.
Was it you?
I had some bread and butter pudding.
Exciting. You've just come back from another Spurs game, crazily enough.
Yeah, just now.
You were at Spurs-Liverpool.
I was.
Okay. Some of us who only watch the highlights, and even then, between drifting in and out of dreams, had the impression that Bale was like a force of nature rampaging up and down that left flank. How good was he, actually?
He was excellent, and he's developed this kind of Ronaldo technique of taking free kicks, and he scored via one yesterday, although I think it took a bit of a deflection off Jordan Henderson's face.
When you say a Ronaldo, not the only thing that took a deflection off her face, of course. When you say a Ronaldo technique, what would that involve? Is it
he stands very kind of, you know, this is me, superhuman.
Yeah, Colossus that bestrides the world type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he gets the kind of same dipping effect on the ball. I mean, that was his sort of trademark when he was coming through at Southampton. He scored, you know, sensational goals from set pieces. And I think more often than not, these often go wide. I think his set piece taking in general over the last year or so has been quite woeful. But, he was excellent last night. Although, there were certain parts of his game that I didn't endear himself to the Liverpool fans. I think they remember the Charlie Adams spat. He got booked for diving. He's now the player who's been booked the most, I think, for diving in the Premier League this season. And he did a bit of a Luis Adriano, where Liverpool had a drop ball and Bale quite unsportingly nicked it off Johnson's toes and tried to. Nothing came of it. But
I wonder
it
if he's going to get a UEFA ban for that.
Well. We'll have to see.
What did the other team, what did the other players do at this point?
Well, Johnson kind of just threw his hands up in the air. The Liverpool bench wanted it to be taken again, but no, it gone. Liverpool had a lot to feel kind of aggrieved about yesterday because I think Spurs were excellent in the first 10 or 15 minutes or so, got themselves ahead, and then pretty much it was all Liverpool. It was a very good performance from Liverpool. They felt they had two penalty claims, which I'm not so sure about.
What did Andre Villas-Boas say about that?
He said that I think a stat that he's aware of is that Phil Dowd is the referee who gives the most penalties in the Premier League. So if he didn't think there were penalties, they weren't penalties.
Sounds fair enough. Did you see AVB post-game? He seemed a little bit more mellow, a little bit more relaxed this time.
Well, they had a really poor run over sort of the last month or so. Now they lost to Arsenal, and now they've gone and won two games pretty convincingly at home. Two difficult games as well. So, yeah, what's he got to be annoyed about? And he was also a bit magnanimous enough to say that Spurs probably should have drawn the game. Liverpool could have come back into it.
So, yeah, that did seem nice of him to say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Dembele's back. Is that the difference, or is this just a team that's actually kind of finding its shape now?
No, I think it is the difference because you just don't have the same dynamic in midfield with Huddleston alongside Sandro. And Dembele was excellent again. I think you can pretty much chart their poor run of form to when he was out. I don't think they've won a game when he's been out of the team.
So
his return is crucial.
What does this mean for Scott Parker? Will he be making a move to QPR?
Apparently he's close to coming back to fitness. AVB was actually quite promising about it yesterday. He said, look, we're getting loads of players back, and he mentioned Parker as being, you know, someone who's going to do them some good over the next coming weeks. Because I think the thing is, when Dembele was out, as I said, Huddleston is just, he doesn't offer the same thing. Mind you, I guess Parker doesn't either. But Sandro's been excellent alongside Dembele as well this season. So might be a little bit difficult for Parker to get back into that team.
I'm just thinking with Harry down the road.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, or indeed up the road. To shout. Those QPR rumours have got to start somewhere. Why not here? Okay, and of course the competition for top four does look a little bit, well, undecided, ill-defined, wide open?
At the moment, yeah. But it's kind of gets like that every season at the start, I think, now, where you get teams like West Brom and Everton who make these really good starts. But it's just whether they can, whether they have the experience, the squad depth, and also just that extra bit of quality to last with the likes of Spurs and Arsenal, who have, you know, Spurs have, although they've been playing fairly poorly in the last few weeks and have come back into it now, they have Bale, and West Brom and Everton don't have a Bale, and they don't have a Cazorla or a Giroud and so on. So you would expect maybe it to level out as you get into sort of January, February, and Arsenal and Spurs to come into it.
Sounds fair enough. Now, at the weekend, Fulham are going to be hosting Spurs, while Liverpool get Southampton at home. Barry, what's your thoughts on Liverpool? Are they moving forward?
No, I think they're regressing.
Are they?
To be honest, well, if you look, they're 17 points from the top of the table, 11 from the bottom. I think when Brendan Rodgers came in, a lot of people thought he was this supremely talented young manager with great ideas, and I was one of them. And then I saw a few episodes of being Liverpool, which made me think that perhaps he's some sort of snake oil merchant and quasi-charlatan. And Liverpool's current league position would suggest that that might be the case. And I could be wrong, but I'm slightly puzzled as to when Liverpool fans are going to start getting very suspicious of this man.
Beyond the large portrait in the living room and the famous episode with the envelopes, was there something else in these?
Just some of the nonsense he comes out with when he's taking players to one side and having words with them, and, you know, pep talks with John Joe Shelby, and the manner in which he sort of picks on Raheem Sterling, the runt of the litter at the time. I don't know if he's putting this show on for the cameras or whether he's like that all the time, but I am starting to get slightly dubious about his methods. I think the whole notion of making that program was not a great idea in the first place. It's good for us to watch. It's quite entertaining, but what it achieves for Liverpool is remains to be seen.
Right. Well, were they to lose at home to Southampton, Barry, what then?
Well, that wouldn't be good, would it?
No, it certainly wouldn't.
They would be sort of in danger of consolidating their status as a mid-table side.
Right. Well, as mentioned, Spurs are going to be at Fulham, who earned another draw there at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea?
It's taken Rafa two games, and it's already, Jorge Valdano might have said, a shit on a stick.
Right.
I was talking to a friend who is a big Chelsea fan, season ticket holder, during the game, and he was kind of beside himself with rage at what they've been watching for the last two games. I was getting angrier texts saying, we've got six men in our own half at home to Fulham. He's playing a defensive winger at home to Fulham. The only players attacking are Oscar and Hazard at home to Fulham. And he left Mata on the bench as well. So I don't think that they're very happy with what they're seeing from Benitez.
Because have got that impression.
No, you wouldn't have at all. But he might say that he's trying to make them more defensive, and they've kept the two clean sheets. But I think with the players they do have, to be so poor against Fulham at home, they're a good side, but
they also concede more goals than almost anybody. Yeah,
That's probably their first. I'm not sure, but it's probably their first clean sheet away from home this season, and they barely created a chance, Chelsea, which maybe is a consequence of having Torres up front.
Mm. Well, yeah, well, more bad news on that score. One man who was at Stamford Bridge yesterday, very possibly waving a bit of A4 in the air, although we can confirm that now, Dominic Fifield. Dominic.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very, very well. How are Chelsea doing, Dominic?
Not quite as well. They're struggling. They look a team shorn of confidence, very brittle. I think Benitez inherited a team that was struggling, but I suppose if he's clinging to positives and that's all he can do at the moment, he has at least not conceded a goal in the two matches he's had. But the atmosphere is fairly poisonous down there at the moment and quite volatile.
Mm. How much is he culpable for the performance in the last two games?
I don't think he is, really. I mean, he's been training. He's had five training sessions so far, and he's been asked to on the one hand, to make things more solid. I mean, they were conceding a lot of goals prior to that. They hadn't had a clean sheet in 10 matches. They obviously had the shambles at Juventus last week. They needed to do something to get some solidity back, but he is struggling to get that balance, that elusive balance between, you know, using the creative attacking players he's got there, Hazard, Oscar and Mata in particular, whilst also retaining some kind of strength at the back. And at the moment, he's sort of got the basis, he's got the foundations to work on, but he's still looking for, you know, that missing sparkle, that missing ingredient that maybe Chelsea had in the first few weeks of the season when they were shipping goals at the other end.
Mm.
I don't think he's culpable particularly for that, but likewise, I don't think he'll ever be accepted by Chelsea fans, and that leads to this sort of combustible relationship and atmosphere down at the bridge at the moment.
Absolutely. In terms of ingratiating himself or winning over the fans, possibly the worst thing he could have done would be drop Mata to the bench.
Yeah, although Mata, I mean, I made that point last night on Twitter, and a few fans came back to me saying that they thought look leggy and sort of tired over the last few matches. And they have played a lot of games, and they have got a lot of games to come in the World Club Championships in Japan. So he does have to balance his squad. Although, when you look at that trio behind Torres, Mata is arguably been their most impressive. Hazard seems to have tailed off completely. And if we weren't obsessing over how poor Fernando Torres is at the moment, we might be scrutinising more how poor Hazard has been over the last month. He isn't ever going to be accepted by Chelsea fans, Benitez. That's just a reality, and I think he's accepting that now as well. His language has changed slightly over the last 2 weeks, and he's now sort of saying that he accepts why there are problems there, and why fans will never really take to him. But you know, just there wasn't any booing before the kickoff yesterday, but there was a fair amount after the final whistle. And it's not going to, when the results don't come, the fans are going to revolt, and it's not conducive to making a happy environment for them all to work in.
No, indeed not. There was also the chant after 16 minutes again for Roberto Di Matteo. If this was Italy, it would be quite simple. The president, having fired the manager and had another bloke in for 2 or 3 weeks, would just go, well, you're not working either, I'll bring back the other bloke who was still under contract. Any chance Chelsea will do that with Roberto Di Matteo, do you think?
I don't think we'll be seeing Roberto Di Matteo come back, but I don't think it's out of the question that Rafa Benitez might not see out the season. I mean, Abramovich was there again last night. He sort of sat in his executive box and watched with a grim face on for the entire match. At the end, he sort of turned on his heels straight out the door at the back without looking back at the pitch, and he's clearly not impressed at all. I mean, it's a weird situation, and as much as we know that Abramovich wants attacking flair out on the pitch, and for a while this season Chelsea actually produced that with a manager that he clearly didn't ever want to be in situ, and now he's sort of gone the other way again. He's gone to Benitez, who, you know, okay, there was some lovely football play by Valencia and on occasion at Liverpool, but generally speaking, he's sort of known as a tactically very, very clever but defensively sound manager, and it's a strange combination. I'm not quite sure how this marriage is ever going to work on the pitch, let alone off it. I mean, off it, it's got its own issues with the Liverpool legacy, but the whole place feels like a mess at the moment. And you know what? It might actually do Chelsea and Benitez a bit of good to get to Japan, get on the other side of the world, and see if they can win a trophy, come back with a trophy, and just start again. And it's only 8 days away or 9 days away before they actually go to Yokohama. So maybe that would be the relief for everybody.
Yeah, possibly so. Before that, they have to go to Upton Park, of course, and it would be fairly disastrous, would it not, if they do not get a result there?
Well, I mean, Jake would probably be better to say how West Ham are playing at the moment, but I mean, the point was made to Benitez that his side might actually be set up better to play away from home in terms of countering teams, although I can't imagine that West Ham will pour at them on Saturday. They just don't... There's no bite up front anymore. Torres, obviously, is going through his own trauma. I think it's 10 hours, 49 minutes since he last scored in the Premier League. They've basically got this shadow playing up front. There's no focus to their front line. They must wish they could have a Lukaku even playing up front for the moment, a bit of presence there. I mean, I don't think anybody really thought that we'd be saying that at the beginning of the season. And Lukaku looks so raw, but now he's doing so well at West Brom, and Chelsea, look at who they're missing in. It's not unthinkable that they'll go to West Ham and fail to score again. I suppose West Ham may struggle. I mean, Chelsea are stronger defensively now than they were, but it's not exactly a feast of football at the moment. This could be a third successive 0-0 draw, quite conceivably.
Jacob, what about that game at Upton Park? How optimistic are you for the Hammers?
I think Dominic's right when he says that West Ham might not pour forward against them. When this is the third sort of big team they've played at Upton Park, and when they played Arsenal, they lost 3-1, but the goals they scored were when they were hit on the counter-attack. And before the United game on Wednesday, Allardyce was saying that the reason they lost to Arsenal was because they started to get on top in the game and they started to come at Arsenal, and that just left that space for the likes of Walcott and Cazorla to exploit. But when Arsenal had the ball sort of just in front of them and West Ham had all their players back, they're very hard to break down, which is what Ferguson said after the game against United last night, where Van Persie scored a lucky goal and they kind of restricted them to basically a lot of shots from outside the area. When they played City at home, again, they were very careful not to leave themselves exposed at the back. So I think Dominic's right when he says it might be quite a cautious, sort of cagey affair. Equally, I think that it would be very interesting to see how Allardyce and Benitez are together, because they did not have a very good relationship when Benitez was at Liverpool. There was a lot of friction between the two. And Allardyce was asked on Tuesday whether he felt any sort of whether he was sorry at all for Benitez, you know, having had the same kind of experiences when he took over at West Ham, and he was very—it was very noticeable that he didn't really have anything kind to say about Benitez. He just kind of said, "Oh, it's difficult for managers," but there wasn't any support there. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see what they're like on the touchline.
No, it certainly will. On Twitter, there was a heat map of comparative heat map between Torres and Berbatov, which seems to indicate, James, and you saw this too, that Berbatov ran about twice as much as Torres did.
Yeah, he was all over the pitch.
Yeah. Well, there was one bit where he'd kind of stood still and like burnt a hole in the thing.
It was all quite cold. There was not much red hot. It looked a bit like, I don't know, you're looking for Loch Ness Monster or something.
Right.
But Torres has a really good record against West Ham. I think the team he scored the most against in the Premier League, he's got 6-6, so...
Really?
I don't know. He might end his...
He scored his first goal for Chelsea against West Ham when he was assisted by a puddle. so yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he goes and gets a hat-trick on Saturday. It would be typical.
I would be very surprised if he got a hat-trick.
It's the law of West Ham that if you're an out-of-form striker and you need a goal...
Right.
Yeah, but West Ham have big...
No, he's got a goal.
He has got a goal now, yeah.
West Ham have big centre-halves and Torres just getting bullied these days. So I couldn't imagine he'll pose much of a problem.
What about Carlton Cole and Carroll against the Chelsea reinforced backline?
Well, it will just be Carroll. He was taken off after about an hour last night against United, and Cole came on and actually could have scored, but he was denied by Lindegaard. Carroll had one volley which went over. But they did create a couple of chances, but their finishing has been sort of just been not great in the last few games, which they need to address basically. And they're creating quite a few chances, and then they're going wide or not really troubling the goalkeeper.
Do you not think that West Ham could get a spectacular victory and really, really throw some gas on this fire?
Yeah, I think it's a match that Benitez won't be relishing at all. The only thing in his favour is that it's not at Stamford Bridge. West Ham, it's a big Sam team, they're well organised, they're going to be good at set pieces, which Chelsea aren't particularly good at defending. They will attack Chelsea down the flanks, which Chelsea, that could be argued that's one of their weak points. And I wouldn't be at all surprised in the current climate if West Ham beat them.
Thanks, Barry. Well, that's it for part one. Coming up in part two, we're going to be talking about some excitement at the top and at the very bottom. Right, excitement at the top of the table, where United are now a whopping 7 points clear of Chelsea in third, and City 6 points clear after they beat Wigan. Not an easy game, Barry Glendenning. And it looked like, when it was 0-0, and Mancini decided to take a forward off, not just any forward, but Sergio Aguero for a defender, that the Italian had lost it. He'd gone bonkers, and yet...
And yet it worked. He'd already taken off Javier Garcia and replaced him with James Milner. And then he took off Aguero and brought on Kolarov, and it seemed strange because Balotelli wasn't playing well and seemed like the obvious candidate to be removed and get hooked. But he left him on, and Balotelli promptly scored as a result of a long-range shot, and that seemed to be what City were reduced to at that stage, long-range efforts from distance. And then a rick by Ali Al-Habsi.
Was a bit of a rick for the second straight game.
He spilled a Dzeko shot into Balotelli's path, which he should have held, and Balotelli got it in the second attempt. And then Milner wrapped up the points with a long-range effort. It was a tremendous goal.
It was a tremendous goal. Sean would say he thraked it.
He did thrake it.
Others would say it stayed hit.
Yes.
Yeah. He really put his foot through it. What else would you say about a goal like that?
He kicked the ball hard
with his football foot.
Right. Like a traction engine.
Yeah. Liquid. Yep. Al-Habsi had gold pie all over his shirt.
He certainly did. Now, United, as we mentioned, beat West Ham.
I thought Wigan were a bit unlucky in that game because they should have had a penalty that, if scored, would have put them 1-0 up, and that would have really put the cat among the pigeons in that game. City should have got one too, but Wigan should have got theirs first.
Right, well, that's interesting. United, are they
you
at home?
You clearly don't think that's interesting at all.
No, it is humouring me. I'm not humouring you, Barry. Jacob, 30 seconds? It was extraordinary, wasn't it? Walcott had scored after, 55?
Yeah.
Was the fastest goal of the season.
Previously, it was Kevin Nolan against Fulham.
And how long did that take?
I think that was
15 minutes.
Seven, is it?
I can't remember.
Right, yeah. we don't know.
No, but that was the quickest one, I think. And then, Van Persie sort of flicked it over.
Describe the dynamic. Because what we do on highlight shows, they wouldn't just say, they'd actually go back to kickoff, and then you'd have that
bit
where they wander around for...
Man United took the kickoff and they were passing it around as they do, and... Yep. There didn't look to be a lot of threat, and then suddenly the West Ham player hadn't touched the ball yet, and Carrick fed it into Van Persie, we're not quite sure whether he meant it or not, whether it was kind of a Bergkamp style genius touch against Newcastle back in 2002, or whether he just kind of miscontrolled it, ended up completely fooling Winston Reid, and it went over his head. And the first time a West Ham player touched it was when James Collins deflected it over Jussi Askalainen, and this all happened inside 33 seconds, I think.
Wow, it's San Marino-esque.
Yeah, and then nothing else happened in the game.
All right, then. Well, that's good. So, there you go, Man United just ahead of City at the top. At the bottom, meantime, Man United are going to be visiting Reading, who are right in the thick of a huge relegation battle. A relegation battle which is opening its doors wide to welcome two friends from the North East, Newcastle and Sunderland. Newcastle got defeated, of course, at Stoke, whereas Sunderland had a 0-0 draw with QPR in a stunningly dull game on Tuesday evening, which Harry Redknapp says he enjoyed hugely. Now, the big game at the bottom this weekend is QPR against Aston Villa. Woof.
I have a feeling that this will be QPR's first win of the season.
Do you think so, James?
Yeah, because I think Villa have had a very poor away from home. They have a very young, inexperienced team.
It was the youngest side fielded in the Premier League this season.
Yeah. I think with eight players under the age of 23.
It was also their lowest attendance, I think, ever for a Premier League game.
Despite Benteke being being a really, you know, a great signing. I just think they haven't got really enough about them. I think you look at QPR's squad, or at least their first 11.
Yeah,
you'd maybe say that it's better than Villa's.
Is it? Even though they haven't got anybody up front to score goals, apart from Cissé, who's a bit mad.
Yeah, but I think on the whole, I think you'd maybe take some of the players. You'd take a few QPR players over Villa players.
Really?
You say that?
I don't know.
I see where you're coming from, but I don't agree that Villa don't have much about them. I think Villa are one good result away from going on a really good run that'll propel them up the table and into safety.
What do you see in them, Barry?
I see the good in them, Jim.
Do you?
Yes.
Do you see a young group of players who just need someone to believe in them?
It's like Luke Skywalker.
Is it?
Well, and then his father.
So many things are. What are you?
Spoiler alert, by the way, in case. I think I've said this before in recent pods. They're like an engine threatened to spark and sputter into life. While I expect QPR to improve under Harry Redknapp, and they already showed signs of improvement against Sunderland, they were sort of held their shape, the actual players playing in the correct position and a bit of protection for the back four and whatnot, I wouldn't imagine they'll win this game.
Really?
Which means they almost certainly will.
Villa were superb against United for that first hour. And then they run out of steam.
But that's so often the case with them, no? They can see more late goals than anybody.
Right, but when you're playing against United, when you run out of steam, it's a bit different. But if they were to do that against QPR, they don't have the players like Hernandez to come off the bench. They've got Cissé and no one else to come off the bench and score those goals.
Right.
And QPR, what they struggled with under Hughes was dealing with the teams who work really hard and put the effort in, which, you know, the games against Southampton and West Ham, which they lost at home. But I think maybe under Redknapp there is going to be a bit more effort being put in.
Well, it's going to be interesting. Also be interesting to see if Darren Bent makes the bench. Or even the first team. The Darren Bent story.
Well, yes. After their match against Reading, the journalists quizzed all but attached electrodes to Paul Lambert's nipples and genitals and quizzed him about Darren Bent's absence from the bench. And yesterday there was an article in The Guardian. Stuart James wrote, 22 questions that were posed, and he basically had a transcript of the press conference. So it wasn't so much 22 questions that Lambert was asked, but rather than one question, he was asked 22 times about why Bent wasn't on the bench, and he pretty much stonewalled them.
Well, he did answer their questions. That they asked if he had a problem with him, and he said no. Do you think he doesn't work hard enough? He says no. Do you think he's not a good player? No, I think he is a good player. I do think he's a good player. But there's clearly something going on, because it's one thing to drop him for Benteke, but to not even have him on the bench.
There are a number of theories doing the rounds, many of which weren't broached in that press conference. One is that it could be a personal thing, some personal issue against Bent, that there's a clause in Bent's contract, which means if he hits a certain number of appearances, that Villa will have to pay Sunderland another £6 million. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know Bent has played 47 league games for Villa, so maybe if he hits 50, they might have to pay up a big wedge of cash that they either can't afford or don't want to pay because they're planning on getting rid of him in January.
£10 million to QPR is the latest hot rumour, is that right?
That they could get rid of him?
Yeah.
Well, possibly. Jacob, QPR need a goal scorer, and Bent is a goal scorer.
We could sign Sandra instead, though.
It's the Harry Redknapp regrettable outburst.
Yeah, he said he regrets it as well. I think he says a lot of things sometimes that he ends up regretting. Because he's such a rent-a-quote that, he'll come out with anything.
I thought that was quite funny. I don't know why. Ben should just get over it and don't be so sensitive.
He didn't like it though, did he? It was a terrible miss though when it happened against Portsmouth. He deserved it, but he is a good goal scorer and they need one, QPR.
All right. Okay, Arsenal, who are coming off a draw away at Everton. That's a good result, isn't it? With that very early goal from Theo Walcott.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were an Arsenal fan.
Walcott's 10th goal of the season.
Is that right?
6-6, yeah.
And yet, Bent's not even on the bench. Walcott's not even on the calendar. Arsenal, this weekend, are hosting Swansea.
Yeah, they lost to Swansea in Wales last season, 3-2. And Swansea were excellent against West Brom last night. Pablo Hernandez. I think a lot of the attention falls on Michu because he scores a lot of goals. But I think one of their signings of the summer has definitely been Hernandez. He's been fantastic. So And yeah, I mean, I think Swansea have changed quite a lot this season. Yeah, I think a lot of people say it's, you know, just another continuity kind of appointment. You know, Martinez, Sosa, Rogers, Laudrup, but they're a lot more direct. Get the ball from defence to attack a lot quicker. They're a bit more counter attacking. So yeah.
I was really surprised they signed Hernandez, because he was actually a good player for Valencia, who were a top European side.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and you know, no offence to Swansea, but you would have thought, you know, if he's available, then a bigger side might have been in for him. But
very good.
We never mentioned Newcastle. We never mentioned the two northeast sides who were struggling.
You're right. Well, we kind of did, Jacob, but mention them a bit more, because they're both plummeting. They're both now two points away from the relegation zone, although... In interest of statistical fairness, I should mention that both Sunderland and Reading below them have a game in hand.
Yeah, no, that Sunderland appear to be in complete freefall at the moment. They've won two games since March, and the two games they've won this season have been against sides with 10 men. I just don't know what kind of side they want to be. If you look at
a championship side,
yeah, but doesn't seem to be any real plan at the moment. They're not direct, they're not passing side, they're not efficient in like how Stoke or West Ham play. They just don't do anything, which is strange, because if you look through the team, there are some good players in there, solid players. Johnson, Sessegnon, Fletcher's a good striker. Seems like a good defence, but O'Neill seems to have no clue as to how to stop the rot. It's just really weird. Hard to work out.
It is hard to work
Whereas Newcastle can't stop losing.
Jacob, I can't believe that as a proper journalist you haven't mentioned the Europa League in conjunction with your Newcastle analysis. Anyway, we'll have some Europa League news coming up a little bit later on in the show. Yeah, it's the same story that you read everywhere else. But we'll also, coming up very, very shortly, have Sid Lowe talking about one of the big games of the European season. It's the Madrid derby, and this time Real Madrid going into it 8 points below their rivals Atleti. It's the derby of your lives. That's what Mark is calling it. We'll hear more after this.
Hello, Jimbo.
Hi, how are you, Sid?
I'm all right, thanks.
You're eating something?
I'm eating a yoghurt.
Yoghurt. What flavour, Sid?
It's a Frutas del Bosque. A Vicente del Bosque yoghurt.
Hey!
I would love Del Bosque to change his first name to Frutas. So instead
that
of being
be fantastic,
Bosque,
wouldn't it?
Yeah, actually called Fruit of the Fruits of the Forest.
Who's the footballer who carries a spoon around with him because he's addicted to yoghurt and he's, in case he ever finds... It's a bit like Lionel Richie who kept a piano.
I don't know, Jimbo, but a footballer who carries a spoon around with him because he's addicted. Are you sure the yoghurt's not just a cover-up?
Sid, you're way ahead of me on this one. Listen, let's talk about the big game this weekend in Madrid.
Yes, let's.
You always say about the fact that Atletico Madrid always blow, this is the game that they always get completely wrong. But could this be, after 13 years, the time when they finally get it right, Sid?
It could be. The trouble is, there's been a few years before where we said it could be because they've played well, or Madrid have come into the game playing badly. And it tends to be that when Madrid are in crisis, the best thing that could possibly happen to them is that Atletico Madrid... There's a great quote from Enrique Cerezo, the Atletico Madrid president, a couple of years ago. He said, when every year we give Real Madrid 9 points, the 6 we lose to them and the 3 that we always take off Barcelona. So that 9 points could be enough to kind of change the league table. But right now, the amazing thing about this is Atletico Madrid are 8 points clear of Real Madrid.
It's fantastic, isn't it, for Atleti fans? So it's at the Bernabeu. Is their record even worse than 13 years there?
No, because the last time... I mean, this is the most ridiculous thing that sort of sums up Atletico Madrid's kind of fatalism and the way that things always seem to go wrong for them. And that nickname that they developed for a while of El Pupas, the Jinx one. The last time they beat Real Madrid, it was at the Bernabeu, and they went down.
Wow.
Now, of course, the good news is if they do beat Real Madrid this year, they certainly won't go down. And I think then it might be time to start thinking, OK, we could perhaps take Atletico Madrid seriously this season as potential title contenders. I'm really reluctant to go that far.
But certainly top two.
But, well, I mean, if they were to beat Real Madrid, obviously they'd be 11 points clear of them.
Yeah.
And 11 points clear, you know, even against a side as good as Real Madrid, one that's going to rack up a lot of points between now and the end of the season, there's no doubt about that, despite their, you know, relative struggles this year, then Atletico Madrid would feel like they were pretty well placed to maybe finish second.
Right. Atletico Madrid, the expectation that they're going to fall off somewhere along the line is why? Because they don't have a big enough squad or what?
The first thing, and this sounds flippant, and Atletico Madrid have to forgive me for saying it, well, the first reason is because they're Atletico Madrid, and it's what tends to happen. But I actually think that mentally and kind of emotionally, they're a different side under Cholo Simeone. I think that they will struggle at times this year against teams that defend deep against them, because they're a side that plays very, very directly, very much on the counter-attack. And I think occasionally when other teams allow Atletico to bring the game to them, they find it harder to break them down. I also think that, it will be very difficult for them to assimilate more than a couple of big injuries, particularly if they were to lose Falcao. Although in the last few weeks, he hasn't been scoring at the rate of earlier in the season. I think his goal this weekend was a first in maybe four games, perhaps five. And they'd scored without him. Raul Garcia in particular and Diego Costa have been important. So they have rotated. They do have a bit of a squad, but I'm just not convinced it's big enough over the course of the season to keep on getting the kind of points totals that I think Madrid and Barcelona will continue to get.
Right. Well, after the defeat against Betis at the weekend, there was a lot of anti-Mourinho talk in the papers. There was that, three pages you were saying in Marker of Mourinho's excuses over the years at Real Madrid. How bad would the situation be for him if they were to lose this game and go to minus 11 from Atleti?
I think it would be pretty bad. I think particularly because it would be against Atletico Madrid, who, as I say, Real Madrid fans take as the team that will always bail them out of a crisis by losing to them. I think it will be significant. In the cup game this week, there was a couple of times when the ultras at one end of the stadium, I mean, not just them, to be fair, but a relatively small chunk of the fans really chanted for Mourinho. And some of the other fans, again, it's very difficult to judge how many, whistled them. And I don't know, it's difficult to judge whether they whistled them because they were saying, don't cheer Mourinho, or if they whistled them because they were saying, don't tell us when to cheer Mourinho, or don't tell us what to do, or because of a slight breakdown in the relationship between those fans and some of the others. It's hard to judge that. But certainly I think that there is a certain degree of division within the fan base at Real Madrid now. It's a division that obviously gets, at the very least, the cracks get papered over by good results. And of course, that's one of the things that we shouldn't forget here. Madrid have got through their Champions League group. And they've done it relatively comfortably, but without playing brilliantly. But they are 11 points behind Barcelona, eight behind Atletico Madrid, and that's kind of a key issue in this. That the Spanish media has talked about the kind of backlash against Mourinho as being about the way he behaves, and there's an element of that. But I think it's more about the fact that look where they are.
That's right. I said it. They're going to scrap the Europa League and make Champions League 64 teams, or maybe not. But they're talking about it, and they always talk about these things first, yeah. And they go, oh yeah, whoops, we did it.
Yeah, it's a bit annoying. It's the same with the European Championship, where that was a 16-team tournament. Euro 2016 is going to be a 24-team tournament. We all think it's going to be diluted.
Yep. We're
going to lose some quality. Probably be the same with the Champions League.
If they do that.
If they do it, yeah.
And they're also going to do the European Championships in 13 cities around Europe.
Yes,
that'd be fun.
I think that's right. Yeah.
With it,
why?
Why? I think it's a special one-off to celebrate the anniversary of the European Championship. So rather than give it to any one country in this kind of pan-continental age that we live in, they're just going to give it to 13 different cities. Rome is on the list, so
that'd be fun.
Yeah, that's interesting.
With the Champions League and the problem with the Europa League partly is that. No one likes it because it takes forever to win it. And
yeah.
So what they're going to do
is... Well, it's like leagues. It takes forever to win a league. What's the problem with that?
Yeah, but then you have the league and then you've got this other tedious competition, which, once it gets into the good bit, it is actually quite entertaining. But at the moment, no one wants to watch any of the matches. So what they're going to do is take that other good competition they've got and make that really long to win as well.
Right.
That doesn't seem to solve a problem.
I've got a solution for them. Make Europa League matches 60 minutes. There you go.
Or go back to the UEFA Cup. How it was.
No. Let's go 60 minutes.
60 minutes.
Yeah.
And bigger goals as well.
Well, you don't have to do that. I just think 60 minutes are more manageable for the TV schedules and for people who have to watch stuff on a Thursday night after two busy nights of Champions League. Also, obviously, move the games to non-Champions League weeks, but that's just staring them in the face. James?
Do you want 15-minute quarters or something?
I'm not bothered about that. I just want the Europa League matches to be a little bit shorter. Then we just get on to the good bit.
How many players? Still 11 aside?
Could do.
Could go 7 aside on a full-size pitch.
Or make it indoor. I don't mind.
Could make it indoor, have five players in each team, and instead of kicking the ball into goals, they should have a bigger ball, which they have to throw into baskets off, say, a backboard. That would be better.
Right.
If you're into that kind of thing.
In other news, I managed to lose the name of the person who'd posted this in, but they said, is racism and anti-Semitism at football matches getting worse, or is the coverage and reporting of it getting better? Now, Jacob, you very much wrote about this week.
And spoke about it on television.
On CNN.
And on the radio.
Right.
How do you know all this?
Pardon?
How do you know I spoke about it on the radio? I heard you. You heard me?
Yes.
It was at 1:30 in the morning.
Ah, so you did. Ha. I didn't hear you. But I knew you. You've spoken of little else.
Yeah. What channel was it? What station was it?
That was Talk Sport.
Really? At 1:30 in the morning?
You're just turning into a one-trick pony, Jacob.
What do you think, Jacob?
Do I think it's getting worse?
Yeah, or is it just
it's getting more coverage.
More coverage.
It's been going on, as I wrote in the piece, it's been going on for years. And it's just that over the last year or so, it's just, I think the fact that Evra reported it has suddenly become that catalyst in English football. And then with John Terry as well, it was impossible to ignore because he was the England captain and lost the England captaincy over it and ended up in court over it, not just in front of the FA, but in an actual criminal trial. So suddenly, when these things happen now, people are on the lookout for it all the time, and a few people have started to realise that it's not on. It's not. Some people are, I think, because of the way football is in sort of its role in sort of working class section of society who would go to it, there is this kind of reaction to the way they call, you know, it's called sort of the post Euro 96 effect of the way that football's become more middle class, and it's the fact that people call it like the sanitization of football. So football fans don't really want to be told what to do, and they think that once you're in a football match you should be able to do what you want, and if you don't like it then don't go. It's, well, if you, I want to watch the football match, though, and I don't want to be sitting there hearing that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, well, Yossi Benayoun doesn't want to hear that either. No. It's nice to see him speaking out about this as well.
Yeah, good. Yeah, and also the irony, of course, is that West Ham have a Jewish chairman whose great grandfather killed himself because of anti-Semitic abuse in the sort of at the turn of the century, and just, you know, on the sort of roles of Jews in football, there's this great book that's just been released, published by Anthony Clavain. Called Does Your Rabbi Know You're Here? And when you sort of when you read about people changing their names, footballers changing their names from something like Goldstein to just a sort of normal English name, so he wouldn't be recognised as a Jew, it's not on to joke about these kind of things and say it's just words, because it has an effect on people.
Yeah, it is astonishing. You actually think that the Evra incident last year represents something of a sea change in the way that people's tolerance to this kind of thing.
Yeah, because it was just such a poisonous affair, and for the fact that those two incidents happened one after the other, it was right there. You couldn't ignore it, and it was two high profile players, wasn't it? It's two of the biggest players in the league, and if we're going to be so critical of, for example, the Serbian FA or whoever else, and say the same things about Blatter and say the Spanish FA for what happened with Aragonés in 2004, then you have to deal with it as well. And to be fair, I think they do deal with it. There is a desire in this country amongst the authorities to stamp this kind of thing out. I don't think that you could necessarily criticise them for that, but I think now the press and fans and managers as well have to speak out about it. I think Allardyce was criticised on Sunday after the game for not condemning it outright. And to be fair to him, I don't think that he hadn't heard the chant. So, and he said, I can't criticise what I haven't heard. And do you want to criticise your own team's fans if there is a slightest chance that?
But after that, he came back during the week, no, and he has.
Yeah, he came back on Tuesday, and he was very. But what he said on Sunday was, I'm not a political animal, I'm not a politician, but this isn't really about politics, it's just about human decency.
Yeah. And how do you feel about West Ham's reaction and the efforts they're trying to get the fans identified?
Yeah, they're still looking for it, and the police had two complaints from I don't know who from, but I don't think they had spoken to them, so they don't know how many fans they're looking for. They've identified two fans were arrested and cautioned for making the Nazi-style salutes, and then one was identified as a season ticket holder and banned for life. They haven't been able to find the other one. West Ham have come out very strongly, and they're completely aghast at what happened. I do think, though, that when we have to keep on stressing that it's a small minority, but the small minority are the ones who tend to have the loudest voices,
mm.
and maybe are the ones who are going to be the, if they're willing to stoop to that low, what else are they going to do if you confront them about it?
Mm.
Which is the problem for sort of decent people in the stands, because there's a mob mentality.
Yeah, indeed, and obviously we've seen the extreme end of this last week in Rome. And efforts there are still going on to identify. Well, two people were arrested after the Tottenham stabbings at Campo dei Fiori.
Mm.
Some suggestions in the Italian papers over the weekend that after these guys were identified, supposedly as Roma fans, that the group they were with actually involved West Ham fans. I don't know if you saw this, James.
Yeah, I did, but I think it's unconfirmed reports. I think Leeds fans were mentioned as well. I mean, the suggestion
being that they'd gone over.
Yeah,
for a bit of a.
Yes, but I stress to say that's completely unconfirmed.
Hmm.
When I used to go and watch Roma Lazio, there would be West Ham flags and Union Jack flags with West Ham emblazoned on it in the Curva Nord.
Is that a Di Canio?
But it was a Di Canio thing, and just like West Ham fans chant Di Canio, so the Lazio fans. Yeah, he's an idol for both clubs. I mean, a lot of people have said it's been sort of too little too late, Lotito making Lazio play with a no-racism slogan on the shirts against Udinese in midweek, and also visiting one of the fans who was very seriously injured in hospital. But, I mean, what I would say is that Lotito has been very hard on Lazio Ultras. I mean, he's very unpopular amongst them because when he took control of the club from Claniotti, who was very sort of clientelism, cronyism. He gave all the Iduru Cibili, you know, sort of rights to sell official Lazio merchandise. He said, no, taking that away from you. You know, he's had bullets sent to him in the post. He's had, he has to have bodyguards. You know, he's not someone who takes this lightly, which I think, you know, a lot of people see incidents that have happened in Rome, particularly in the last 6 years, going back even further to 1984. And think, you know, no one takes any action against this. People do take this very seriously. I mean, with Lazio, I mean, they were banned from Europe in 1973. There's a UEFA Cup tie with Ipswich, you know, clashes outside the stadium. And they
clashes on the field as well. There's an almighty brawl in that game.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they were banned initially for 3 years. That was reduced to 1 year. And it was the year they won the league as well for the first ever time. So they couldn't defend, you know, the league in the European Cup, so it did hurt them. But I think in that specific case, because these incidents happened away from the ground, it's not technically in UEFA's jurisdiction, so they can't necessarily take action or impose any bans. The sort of malevolent thing is that the suspicion is that this group who attacked the Spurs fans was a sort of mix between Roma and Lazio Ultras, and I'd stress that it's probably not just a typical incident of football violence. Yeah, I think the fact is, in Italy over the last 10-20 years, both Curvas have been sort of infiltrated by, you know, far right groups, and I think a lot of people have isolated this particular act of violence into looking at, you know, the other incidents, particularly involving travelling support to go watch their teams play Roma.
Mm.
The reality is anti-Semitism has been, and race, anti-Semitism and just acts of violence, particularly in Campo dei Fiori, have been up on the up outside of football matches in Rome over the last decade. It's not specifically a football, just an act of hooliganism. You know, there's much more going on than that.
On the sort of I wouldn't want to specifically demonise West Ham fans as well, because I think when you play Spurs, it's other London clubs as well. You would hear it from Arsenal fans. Arsenal fans have been in contact with me saying, yeah, I'm completely shocked when you hear the hissing, and Chelsea fans have been guilty of it as well. And what some people have said is, you can't just throw these people out because they need to be educated, and they don't know their history. And I think there's a sort of there is an element of that, but also when I've kind of been thinking about it since then, is that they know their history enough to know about the gas chambers, so, but they think it's okay to sing about it.
Who was the manager who this week who described his team's defending as
Brian Laws?
Brian Laws.
Yeah,
it's worse than the Holocaust.
But that's just someone being stupid. That's not a, you know, that's not. It's just like
the time Alan Pardew described, yeah, you know, one player as a show, he raped him. You know, it's a figure of speech used in football circles. There's no malice intended. It's just dim-witted. Of course, Jacob being on TV a lot now means you have to get in on the act.
Up my game.
Yeah. So what are you on tomorrow?
I'm on The Right Stuff tomorrow morning, Barry. Yeah.
Good show.
It certainly is.
Hard hitting.
Well, might be tomorrow.
Up to the minute.
Yeah. I'm being invited on. It's a Channel 5 show to talk about Channel 5's World's Strongest Man, the preliminaries of which are currently airing, but the finals, the real deal, I'm not sure when they're on. Actually, later in December.
It's generally Christmas.
It's a Christmas thing, isn't it? You know, it's part of Christmas.
You're flicking through the channels.
Yeah.
Ah, look, World's Strongest Man.
That's right. Keep flicking. Yeah.
Watch something else.
All right. But in other top ratings news, I also will be appearing, of course, from Midnight Thursday with The Guardian's very own Friday Paper Review. Oof. There's some exciting things in there. Bit of Joey Barton. A little bit of, what else? Ooh, Mourinho's excuses. Other stuff too, no doubt. Hey? Anyway, that, in the meantime, is it for today's pod of Football Weekly. Many thanks to Barry Glendenning, to Jacob Steinberg and James Horncastle, to you, listener, and to producer Ben. Have a super weekend. We'll catch up with you on Monday.
Don't forget, to get your half-price copy of I Am The Secret Footballer, get yourself over to guardianbookshop.co.uk/secretfootballer and enter the offer code FOOTBALL. But remember, it's our little secret.